You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Hey, KBOO supporters. This is Cat Meow, KBOO's board president. Due to the COVID-19 crisis, KBOO has had to cancel our annual spring membership drive. Canceling such an important fundraiser was not an easy choice, but thanks to an anonymous donor, every dollar contributed now through May 31st will be matched up to $20,000. We know that times are tough right now, so we're asking those of you who are able to give to donate today at kboo.fm/give. Financial support from our listeners is what allows community radio to carry out the important role we play in times like these. Give today at our website. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Thanks for your support, and thanks for tuning in.
Today, from the Wings Archive, some genderqueer history.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Back in 1996, Caitlin Sullivan and Kate Bornstein spoke with Sue Supriano about their new novel, Nearly Roadkill, an Infobon erotic adventure, based on the author's own explorations of non-binary sex on the nascent World Wide Web. In this second decade of the 21st century, the book is being revived as classic queer science fiction dealing with issues that are still contentious today.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guests today are Caitlin Sullivan and Kate Bornstein, and it's going to be a very interesting conversation. They are both authors and have written a book together called Nearly Roadkill, an Infobon erotic adventure. That is the one they wrote together, and Kate Bornstein wrote Gender Outlaw on Men, Women, and the Rest of Us. Kate Bornstein is a transsexual person who has gone from a male to a female, right? Is that how you identify? That's the whole subject of the book, is how, all about this gender identification. Here I am asking you this question, trying to put you in a box right off the bat.
Right. which book did you where are you referring to?
How do you identify it according to which book?
Yeah.
Okay, talk about that. It kind of changes.
Well, you know, I started out male in the culture, and I went through all the surgeries and the hormones and the psychiatric whatevers and figured, okay, great, I'm a woman, I have arrived, I am woman, hear me roar. And so I roared, but it really wasn't very womanly. And I decided woman wasn't right either, and tossed that one aside for favor of not man, not woman. That's kind of how I identify now, which led, I think, a great deal to the novel, Nearly Roadkill. What Caitlin and I are fond of saying is that if gender outlaw is the theory, then Nearly Roadkill is the practical.
Mm-hmm. And in Nearly Roadkill, you are writing to each other on the net, on the internet.
Well, the two fictional characters are, yes.
Oh, excuse me. Right. Snatch and Wink.
Scratch.
Scratch. Oh, my God. Oh, my God, do I have to start over?
I want to go back on that.
No, that's great. Well, yeah, it's Scratch. Scratch and Wink are the two main characters of Nearly Roadkill, and they're basically two people who meet on the net and have this wonderful round of cyber sex, fall for each other, and decide at the end of it that they really don't want to know what the other person is in their real life, you know, what gender, what race, what age, and they're not particularly interested in telling what they are, so they agree not to tell. And all during the course of the book, they meet in different ages and races and genders and combinations, and sometimes they know it's the other person and sometimes they don't, but they always keep falling for each other. It's kind of a love story.
Right, and then there are all these different rooms and ways in which to meet. Not only can you have different identities, but you meet in different places, so it's on the net.
Right, Caitlin?
Right. And they also have to encounter their own prejudices that normally they might cross the street to avoid someone like that. And then they find themselves having a great conversation and, in fact, falling in love and hating the way that the prejudices come up inside them. Oh, I realize if you were this normally in my offline life, I wouldn't have a conversation with you. And they get very frustrated with themselves, and they get frustrated with each other. And that's part of the fun, is watching them deal with things quite close up. I mean, if you have a correspondence with somebody, email or otherwise, and you find yourself hitting those prejudices, do you hide that from the other person? Do you explore it together? What do you do? So that's one of the things that's fun in Nearly Roadkill, to watch develop and evolve. Mm-hmm.
And we have so many prejudices, and the one you're particularly looking at is gender. I really love the way that you bring that up to the light, because so few people are thinking critically, or not as many as I would like, are thinking critically these days. And race is something that I'm always trying to talk about, my particular passion. A lot of people have said, oh, you're so interested in that. Most of us aren't so interested in that subject. Mm-hmm. You know, just using these words and making these assumptions like there's some kind of absolute truth without really thinking about it, and kind of just having the arguments based on common assumptions that we're talking about some kind of truth, and then we disagree. Anyway, I'm sure you can probably be more articulate about it than I, but that's what you seem to be doing about gender to some extent.
Well, yeah, on the internet, you're sitting there at your computer, you're typing into a keyboard and words appear on a screen. You don't know where they're appearing or who's looking at them. The words come back at you and you get into a conversation. I remember, and we do have one section in the novel, that one of the characters, Wink, is talking with Scratch, and it's just going on and on and on and on and about this, that, and the other thing. And Scratch says, well, wait a minute, you don't know my race. What if I was, you know, a person of color? And Wink just goes totally red in the face, going, oh, my God, you know, I never thought of it. I just assumed. And it's that kind of prejudicial thinking, I think, where we just assume white if we're white. We just assume that a person is traditionally gendered if we're traditionally gendered. We assume, we ask a question, male or female, not knowing that quite a few people in the culture are beginning to identify as neither. And those are some of the points we hope to bring up in the book.
Mm-hmm. I understand a lot of people actually do, it's not uncommon to go on the internet and be a different gender and race and whatever. Is that so? Do you know much about that, Kate?
Yeah. It used to be that the majority of people online were men, and there was about 80% white males on the net. As women started coming on and people of color started coming on, they started noticing the offline values were still there. For example, if I went on and I said my name is Caitlin, or if I said my name is Susan, I would be targeted with personal messages saying, hey, baby, you want to go on a date? No different than going out in the street. And here I am in my pajamas at my computer, you know, with no worries about that, and I got so frustrated. I was like, my God. And so I picked, I can't remember what my first neutral name was. I think it was Sandy or Chris or something like that, so that I wouldn't be treated that way. And sure enough, I went back into the same room, and I, you know, it was such a vast difference. It was like, what do you think about the state of politics today, Chris? You know, it was such a difference that then, after getting kind of frustrated that it had happened that way initially, then I started getting emboldened that I could go on to any room and be anything. I could also say I was younger. I could say I was older. It depends. I could say I was a gay man. I could say anything I wanted. And I got the most important thing to me was that I got to listen to people who normally would not talk to this particular white female. And that was amazing. And I just listened a lot.
So that was the main thing that was just fascinating to you, to pursue this. How about you, Kate?
For me, I think the great joy came from holding simultaneous conversations. You can have a lot of little windows opening up on your computer and have these private conversations, and in one I might be a 23-year-old skateboard dude. And another one, I might be a divorcee, kind of 45-year-old woman secretary talking to another divorcee, 25-year-old woman secretary. At least that's what she said she was. And yet another one, I could be a gay muscle dude, you know. And another one, I could be a little transvestite girl who likes to put on mustaches and be a boy. And having them all simultaneously, that's my joy, because that for me, what Caitlin came up with, it with a wonderful term, and I think you should really explain it, the whole idea of traction, and how we lose traction in identity.
Okay, that's a cue. One of the things that we noticed right off the bat, although we had been doing a lot of this in theory in our letters to each other, was how much you hold on to your various identities. And even if you get rid of, okay, I'm no longer a student, I'm no longer a radio person, I'm no longer, there are some you just hold on to for life, and a lot of them are cultural, and a lot of them are what you're raised with. So we were trying, in our work with gender, to meet each other online with no gender, with no anything, and to see if desire was still there. And we found we got pretty freaked out that you need something to hold on to, Democrat, female, toothpaste user, whatever, something that'll make you feel connected to something, even if it's transitory. So we found ourselves going, who am I, who am I, who am I? If you won't say who you are or what you are, what does that make me? And so it was experiencing a loss of traction. And there's a sense of literally vertigo. In fact, we had one person who interviewed us who experienced not being able to step on the subway, realizing that if she was not this or that or the other, if she was going to let go of all those things, how would she know what she was going to do that day? How much we root ourselves through the course of even an hour in cat owner, you know, resident of California, whatever it is. And we found that we could not get very far when we tried to do no traction. We could get rid of gender for a while, but we couldn't get rid of top and bottom. Somebody had to have power. And we were just, you know, it was like, damn, why can't we do this? But at least, you know, we at least push the envelope a little further than what you do when you encounter people on the street.
You're right. I'm just thinking about the Buddhist notion of there is no I, there's no separation, there's no identity, it's all impermanent, changing, what we call emptiness. And that's really what you're dealing with, that groundlessness. Yes. So it's deep.
One of the characters at one point quotes Huang Tzu, Taoist philosopher, Chinese Taoist philosopher, who says that the purpose, the mouse trap exists for the purpose of the mouse. Once you've got the mouse, you don't need the mouse trap. Similarly, the fishing pole exists for the purpose of the fish. You've got a fish, you can forget about the pole. He goes on to say that words exist for the purpose of their meaning. Once you've got their meaning, you don't need the words. And he said, he summed it up by saying he was looking for someone who had forgotten the words so that they could sit down and have a meaningful conversation. Mm-hmm. And I took from this, and what we got from this out of the book and this whole idea of identities is I'm coming to the opinion that identities exist for the purpose of connection and relationship. Once you've got connection and relationship, you can forget the identities. And me, I'm looking for someone who has forgotten identities so that we might have a meaningful relationship.
Well, and you certainly have been closer to this identity question than most people, although probably most people deal with it a lot more than they talk about. You're saying, I don't know, it's from the look on your face, Kate Bornstein.
Yeah, I assume you're talking about the whole gender deal. I'm changing my gender several times in one lifetime. I don't think that's any more startling or any more profound than someone getting sober after they've been, you know, an active alcoholic for 14 years. I don't think it's any more profound than someone coming out of the closet as gay, or a gay person coming out of the closet as bisexual, or a lesbian separatist coming out of the closet as, you know, I'm heterosexual and that's what it is. We all go through profound changes. And right now, yeah, it's sexy, it's chic, transsexuality hasn't been talked about, but it's no more profound than other changes people go through. And that's what we try to get to in Nearly Roadkill through these two characters, Scratch and Wink, unwittingly running afoul of a government plot to put us all in these little boxes, these commercialized boxes, so that they can promote to us much better. They unwittingly unite all the citizens of the web in a common struggle. And it's the commonality, I think, that's the key. Uh-huh.
From the Wings Archive, you're listening to Kate Bornstein and Caitlin Sullivan telling Sue Supriano about their novel Nearly Roadkill, an Infobon erotic adventure, based on their explorations of non-binary sexuality in the early years of the World Wide Web. It was published by High Risk Books in 1996 and was nearly 400 pages long.
I have to admit to the listeners that I read part of the book and I wish I had time to read more. It's written in an unusual style. It's all different kind of bold print and that bold print, and it's different spaces on the page, and it's the most unusual and reminds you of a computer for sure. Did you know each other before you started? I had the idea before we started this interview that you did not know each other before you started writing this book over the internet. But you said, no, that's not true. But tell me some, if you would, about how you did write this book, Nearly Roadkill.
We're trying to emulate the world of the computer. We're also trying to target to people who have had a lot of experience on the net and those who've never turned on a computer. We're both really literature nuts, and we would never want to abandon books, you know, for computers. So we use different fonts. We indent the text. We do things to show transitions. And Kate can talk a little more about written speech. But Kate and I were friends through the mail, you know, the snail mail. And we're writing long theories about gender, and I was asking a lot of questions, and she was asking a lot of questions of me. And the book grew out of that, and I feel in some ways that there was the way we knew each other before we went online together to write the book, and the way we learned who each other was online, because we would literally go on as these characters. Okay, you be Wink, I'll be Scratch. Let's say they're going to meet as a heterosexual couple tonight. Okay, let's go. And we had no idea where we were going to go. That's all we had. It was like an improvised play. Next night, okay, let's be two gay men. It was very strange. And then we would have email about the experience. Wow, that blew my mind the time you went da-da-da-da-da, you know.
The meta-communication.
Exactly. And so we fashioned a plot after having several talks like that. We decided to write the book and fashioned a plot, and we thought it'd just be a matter of saving all those wonderful chats and wrapping them up in 3 months, and then there'd be a book. Of course, that turned out not to be true, and we had to make a real plot, you know, with real chapters and all that. But there was also the other meta conversation was about the book itself, you know, where we would despair at certain places that we'd gotten to, like the thing about no traction. Or realize that we had terrible prejudices that we didn't want to admit to ourselves or to each other. And we would have live chats with each other about it because Kate was in San Francisco and I was in Seattle, and it's cheaper to go online.
And you'd never laid eyes on each other, really?
Oh, no, we had. Oh. But it had been a year by then, I think, then we'd see that we had seen each other or something like that. I can't remember. But
a while.
That was the majority of, that was where we related was online. So yeah, typing our little keyboards late into the night. And then we started saving those chats and realizing the characters could go there too. The characters could get freaked out and say, you know, I don't like what just happened. And we went ahead and saved that. We got very, very brave about saving everything, even if it was something that made us embarrassed or made us realize we weren't as liberal as we thought and blah, 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 blah.
So you had to get over that embarrassment, I guess, to publish it, put it out there.
Well, I think that's what makes when I like to read, I like to see people get in touch with their own weaknesses and to start taking them on as challenges. And Scratch and Wink and Nearly Roadkill are no exceptions. Early on in the book, we say one's confused and one's a ditz, and but they're for quite a few good reasons, and those reasons come out over the course of the book. And they do, they like to use the metaphor of I'm gnawing on this one, I'm gnawing on this one like a bone. They both like to use that one, and they don't let go of it, of things, and they do hang in there. At one point, one of them wants to just say, okay, goodbye, have a good life. And the other one says, uh-uh, you're not getting away with it that easily. No, we're going to get to know each other here. And that's the kind of person I like like to be with. That's the kind of person I like to read about.
Mm-hmm. And it's actually more easy than in many books to follow these things going on simultaneously, or different conversations going on, because of the different fonts you use and the way it's arranged in the book. Did you want to say something about that, Kate?
What happens on the net is you're typing as though you were talking. You're not typing as though you're writing a letter to someone, because it's live. It's happening back and forth and back and forth. And so a lot of the language in the early Roadkill is written speech, not literature. These are people talking. Both Caitlin and I have a theatrical background, and we're used to writing dialogue for actors on stage. And I think you were saying something about Mark Twain. This has some... Could you? Because I'm not so quite so literary knowledge, and I'm just going to... Could you put the microphone over to her?
Stage direction. Well, just that lots of different... Anthony Burgess, that's it. Anthony Burgess wrote Clockwork Orange, and he changed literature with using different language. He used slang of London street punks, and he had to have a glossary to follow it. The same with Mark Twain. You know, he changed literature by actually writing down a dialect that he knew from his boyhood days in Mississippi. It's become more common now, and a lot of literature reflects lots of different kinds of ways of speaking. We're not being forced so much to accept the sort of Oxford English ways of speaking. People don't talk that way, and I'm glad to see literature, you know, expanding to reflect how people really talk. So in some ways, we're doing something like that in reflecting what the online language is, which is fascinating. There's abbreviations, there's shorthand, there's a whole language in and unto itself. I mean, if you have to get up from your keyboard to go to the bathroom in the middle of a chat, you know, you don't want to type all that out. You would type BRB, which means be right back. And everybody knows why, you know, or maybe you're getting a cup of coffee. And there's those kinds of things, and that in turn influences the slang that happens offline.
Uh-huh. And I might say that this is a very erotic book, to say the least, with the sexy chats, which is an understatement.
When any new technology comes along, be it radio, television, ham radio, letters, telephones, one of the first things it gets grabbed and used for is sex and desire and sexual connection. And at first I was kind of embarrassed about that, and I was going, well, there's not all that much sex on the net. I mean, but there is. There's lots of it. It's tons of it. And the way Scratch and Wink meet is the way a lot of people typically meet on the net. They connect at the point of their heart's desire. There's something really animal, there's something very passionate. But then, and this is what happens on the net, which is so beautiful, because the net, again, as Caitlin was saying, is safe. You're not going to get beat up for stuff. Once it's over, you can talk with each other. You've established the connection. And we watch what happens. They keep doing lots of sex things, and that's great. But more and more and more, they're getting deeper and deeper with each other, which actually ends up making their sex better.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I think about this thing that I've heard about, the difference between men and women, and one of these things about what is the difference between men, explorations of what is the difference between men and women, that women need intimacy to feel sexual, and men need sexuality to feel intimate. I don't know if you want to comment on that and how it relates to the internet or anything else.
Actually, I have been of that belief too, but I have been surprised, having surfed in different personas, having had sex with a man as a man, having sex with a woman as a man, having sex with a woman as a woman online, I find that different people want levels of intimacy depending on the day and where they're from, as much as anything else. I've been surprised, as Kate was saying, you get down to the essence of what a person is. If a man, who typically we see a white man, we typically see as having a lot of power in this culture, gets to go online without that persona for once, without dragging all his power along, I found incredible vulnerabilities in those men. I found them deeply wishing to be equal. I'm not saying that within every white man beats the heart of an egalitarian. I would never go that far, but I've been surprised. And I've, again, those were some of the prejudices I had to drop as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can have that kind of hard and fast rule, although I've been operating under it for years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, that, you know, which came first, the you know, the rule or the fact that we follow it. I don't know. But I know that on the net, rules and assumptions show up very, very, very loudly. It's kind of someone like, it's like wearing a white T-shirt and something, you spill spaghetti sauce all over it. They show up when someone says, why? They're not afraid to ask questions on the net. You know, if someone says, well, I'm a guy, I only date, I have to know whether you're a man or a woman because I'm a guy and I only date women. You can go, why? And they can go, you know, I hadn't thought about that. Mm-hmm. They have that. They also have that safety. They can let down that macho whatever that they have to keep up in their daily lives, or they get trampled or eaten, by their office mates, and they can just say, I want to think about that. I'll get back to you. Send me some email or whatever.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit on the very little bit of time we have left here about the issue of the commercialness of the internet, and I think that you address that in your book, Nearly Roadkill, of Caitlin Sullivan and Kate Bornstein. You're nodding, Caitlin?
Sure. Yeah. Well, every medium has also, in the same way that every medium gets used for sex, every medium also gets used for business and commercials. And the thing about the net that's very different, although there are similarities, is that it's two-way. It's instantaneously two-way. So, for example, the first time a couple of lawyers went out on the net to advertise their business, they were completely slammed because they were seen as what they were, which is opportunistic and self-aggrandizing, whereas this is an area of people being equal. But what is happening now is that commercial services are offering better access to the net, easier access, more and more people can get on, and in turn they want to know what toothpaste you use, what gender you are, so they can assume that you want pantyhose ads. So some of the same things are happening. What we're trying to do in Nearly Roadkill is have what would happen if all those people said, no, I don't want to know about pantyhose.
I sure don't. Like, and how about this whole gender issue? Do you feel like you've really stirred up a lot of conversation about it on the net or anywhere else?
Well, we hope so. Yeah. Controversy is great, but we're not the first to do that. The gender-free pronouns that we came up with, we took one of them from the net. People have started using those pronouns, like the word ze, and here, h-i-r, because when you're trying to have a philosophical discussion, you don't want to get hung up on he or she, you know. So, no, gender is a big thing on the net. Lots of people are exploring it from lots of different angles that we've never even thought of.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Well, Kate Bornstein is also a performer, and Caitlin Sullivan is also a radio producer, and they are the co-authors of Nearly Roadkill, an Infobon erotic adventure, and Kate Bornstein also wrote Gender Outlaw. Thank you very much. My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.
We are sad to report that the interviewer on this story, Sue Supriano, has passed away. The novel Nearly Roadkill, an Infobon erotic adventure, by Caitlin Sullivan and Kate Bornstein, was published in 1996 and is now out of print. Its website has also been taken down, but reviews and articles about it continue to appear, and it's been assigned as a text for a 2019 course on queering science fiction. In 2018, its continued relevance was attested in a review by Bogi Takash. Takash writes, "If we can get past the technical details of an almost entirely text-only internet, where the term website still needs to be laboriously explained, we find some of the most groundbreaking discussions about gender and sexuality in speculative fiction, discussions that are still just as powerful as when they were written." Wink is a non-binary person who had previously lived as a trans woman, while Scratch is the kind of second-wave feminist cis woman who wants to abolish gender. Their views clash very sharply, and all the terrible arguments that surface are disputes that still play out today. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org, or for very recent shows, visit our new website, wingsradio.org/WordPress. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose work on the gift economy can be found at gift-economy.com. The Wing Sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle Is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Good morning, this is Disability Justice, an everyday pursuit and survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
And Dina Wilder, board operator.
In the studio today with me is Sarah Nowak. Good morning, Sarah. So, what is the brokerage services? And would you mind introducing yourself, by the way, as well?
Oh, sure. Yeah, good morning. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me. I am Sarah Nowak, as you said. I am the director for UCP's brokerage program.
And what is a brokerage?
Well, that's a good question. It's a big question. Basically, what a brokerage does is we provide case management services for adults who experience intellectual or developmental disabilities who are living independently in the community. So in Oregon, there's kind of two tracks for services. There are people who live in foster homes or group homes, and then there's everybody else who's eligible for services but not living in a foster home or a group home.
So people in foster homes and group homes, why are they excluded from? It doesn't seem like they're added to your roster. Why is that?
Yeah, they get their case management services through the County Developmental Disability Program, and that's how services are designed in Oregon currently.
But what if a person preferred to have a brokerage rather than county case management?
That is not something that can happen currently in Oregon.
That's a topic for another time, but we will go into that sometime soon.
That sounds good.
All right, let's circle back to brokerage services. Do you mind continuing, Sarah?
Sounds good. Basically, what a brokerage does is we have case management services, and when we are working with one of the people who we support, and we call them customers, we initially go through a person-centered planning process where we are getting to know them, getting to understand what's important to them, and identifying what their goals in life are.
And who is doing this process?
That's a good question. Their personal agent is doing that. And the personal agent is an employee of the brokerage who is assigned to work with the customer.
So it's not you doing that process.
Right.
All right.
Yeah. So the personal agent is going through a person-centered planning process to identify what the customer's goals are for their life. And then another person, an assessor, who's also an employee of the brokerage, will complete an evaluation of the person's disability-related support needs.
And when you say employee of the brokerage, is that the person's personal agent that's doing that?
No, they're an assessor, so it's a totally different person from the personal agent.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So the assessor is completing that evaluation, and then the personal agent steps back in to take all of that information from the individual and from the assessor to put that in a plan that includes what the person's goals are for their life and over the next year, as well as what resources they might need in order to get the support that they need to take steps towards their goals.
And so the person-centered planning is just identifying the needs? Does it help them procure the resources that they need?
They're kind of separate processes. So the person-centered planning process is designed to really understand the person, what's important to them, what kinds of things are going on in their life already, who their family is, who their friends are, and kind of like looking at all of those key pieces of a person's life. And then our role is to kind of look at what's not happening for that person, like where are the gaps or where is something missing, and where can we provide some additional supports to assist that person to take steps towards whatever is the most important thing for them.
So, Sarah, can you explain to me further the process of assessment?
Sure. So when an individual is eligible to receive certain kinds of funded supports, then we would coordinate an assessment for them. And that assessment is called the Adult Needs Assessment or the Oregon Needs Assessment. And each brokerage has an assessor who's on staff with them who conducts the assessment. And the assessment looks at the different areas of a person's life, like their home life, their medical needs, how they communicate, how they respond to emergencies, things like that. And it evaluates the level of assistance that they might need in order to engage in those areas of their life.
So when you say assessing and needs, does that mean this is the part of the assessment that is actually giving a client its hour or their hours?
Yes.
And allowing them, giving them this resource of hours to allocate to their caregivers?
Yes, yes. Thanks for bringing that up. So the outcome of the assessment is that it determines the number of hours that are available for an individual to use to hire direct support providers to assist them in their life.
And just from the few conversations I've had from clients, I noticed there's constant confusion between individual plannings and needs assessments, that everybody thinks, well, I go through my individual plan, that's where I get my hours. It's not actually where the hours are coming from, is it? It's coming more from the needs assessment?
Yeah, that's a great point. So the planning, the plan that we put together, talks about goals, resources, next steps, those kinds of things. And the results of the assessment are incorporated into the plan, but they're two separate processes and they're completed by two different people.
Why are there two different processes? Why not just make it one process and make it less confusing for everybody?
Yeah, that's a good question. The kind of logic behind that is that there is a conflict of interest for a personal agent to act as an advocate for the person who they're supporting, as well as be a person who's assessing them and giving them resources. And so in Oregon, the state has decided to separate those duties so that that conflict of interest doesn't exist. So the personal agent is the person who is an advocate and kind of walks alongside the individual, and the assessor is the person who will evaluate support needs, and then the outcome of that assessment actually allocates resources that are available to the individual.
So after the assessment, what happens next?
Yeah, so then the personal agent is going to take all of that information from the person-centered planning process and from the assessment, and they're going to develop a plan, an individualized support plan for the customer. And that plan is going to lay out all of the things that can happen over the next year. And then the personal agent's role in that is to coordinate a variety of resources and support for the individual to take steps towards their goals. Sometimes that might include funded paid supports through the brokerage, for example, working with a direct support provider to get out into the community, or getting assistance on the job, that kind of thing. Sometimes the personal agent might be accessing another community resource. So the personal agent's role is to pull from as many different areas, resources as possible to support the individual to work on their goals.
So, Sarah, can you tell me a little more about the other resources within UCP?
Yeah. One of the really great things about brokerages is that we can all kind of design how we respond to the needs of the people we support. And at UCP, how we've done that is we have designed what we call personal agent liaison positions. And these are personal agents who are working with, you know, some fewer customers and who then specialize in a few different areas. So we have a personal agent liaison who specializes in housing. We have a personal agent liaison, we call them PALs, who specializes in community resources. We have a PAL who specializes in employment, and then we have a bilingual Spanish-speaking PAL.
Any chance that you'll have a PAL that helps with navigating the system?
Possibly. We're working right now with our advisory board and our customers and our team members around getting feedback from them on the things that are important to them and the things that are barriers to them. And we're putting together a plan for how to be responsive to these new needs. And that's something that's coming up through that process. So we'll see what happens.
All right. Anything else that we should know about?
Yeah, we have a couple of other positions. We have our advocacy and outreach coordinator who supports our self-advocates group called Speak Up, Speak Out, and who also is really involved in other advocacy groups and initiatives in the community. The advocacy and outreach coordinator works with other organizations and advocacy groups and provides support. So that's one other position that we have at UCP. And we also have a customer peer mentor position in development. We don't have that position filled yet, but the idea there is that it would be a person who is served through our brokerage, and their goals would be to provide information and education to other brokerage customers about the services that are available to them, what to expect as they're working with a brokerage.
So you're talking about an actual peer, mm-hmm. a person with an intellectual disability, helping others out with an intellectual disability, help guide them through the system.
Yes, that's it exactly.
That sounds really good.
I think so too. We're really excited about being able to bring that person on board.
Any idea how soon that might actually occur?
I don't have a timeline.
All right. So, Sarah, is it inside or outside of UCP that you're looking for this customer mentor?
We'll be looking for a customer of UCP Connections.
So, Sarah, can you tell me about the size of caseloads?
Yeah, so at UCP, our personal agents work with anywhere from 35 to 39 individuals. And statewide, there is a cap on the number of people that a personal agent can support. That's set at 45.
45. Mm-hmm. How is that for county case management? How many would that be for county case management?
Well, county case management services don't have a cap on the number of people that can be served by any individual service coordinator at the county.
Don't have a cap?
They do not have a cap.
Are you telling me they can have 80, 100, 200, go even higher than that?
I don't think I've ever heard of anything going as high as 200 or more, but I do know that they can get up there. The counties don't have a different contractual relationship with the state, and so they aren't able to limit the number of people that they're serving at any given moment, or limit the number of people that an individual service coordinator can support.
But wouldn't it be, couldn't you say that like at 80, it's a little difficult to get your, it's a little difficult to get your, let's say the ideal number is 25. Mm. When you've got something like 45, that's doable, but it's very hard to get to know your clients. And then we got county case management on top of that, and my guess is they probably don't even know the names of their clients, or at least three quarters of their clients they probably don't know the names of. Only the ones in crisis would they know the names of. Obviously, this is doing a very strong disservice to anybody with a disability, let alone anybody with an intellectual disability who's perhaps a little more vulnerable than somebody who doesn't have an intellectual disability. Has the state ever had any response to these huge numbers that would seem to leave it wide open for really bad things to happen to people when they should be bringing it down to the caseload of 25 so the case managers and the personal agents can get to know their clients and figure out what their difficulties are?
Well, I think that is a great question for somebody at the state. And I think that everybody throughout, you know, whether they're working at a brokerage or the state or the county, I think everybody would be in support of lowering caseloads to 25. That would be amazing.
Was there any bills or anything like that out there for lowering these caseloads? No, there wasn't.
No, not this session.
When it comes to caseload management, it sounds like we need some advocacy around it, some big-time advocacy.
I agree. I'm totally in support of that.
So, Sarah, what do you like about brokerage services?
One of my favorite things about brokerage services is that they were designed by people who were going to access services. And something that was really important to that group of people who initially designed what brokerage services were going to look like in Oregon is that our services are based around the principles of self-determination. So, and I really appreciate that it's not just something like a nice concept that we just talk about. The principles of self-determination are built into our rules and guide all of the decisions that we make in terms of how we provide services to our customers.
I know that UCP puts out a customer survey once a year. Do I have that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do the other brokerages do that as well?
Yeah, I believe that they do, or most of them do. It's one of the things that, it used to be required that we had to do it every year, and I think that's changed, but I think most of them still do a survey.
Hmm. Any idea what kind of questions pop up on the survey?
Well, the questions that we ask are all about how are things going with your personal agent? Are you satisfied with the services that you're receiving? Would you like to know more about brokerage services? Those kinds of questions.
So a lot of that seems to be around self-determining and self-guiding your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And your life plan. Does this ever change in any way when it comes to self-determination as, let's say, when you're a younger person or when you're in the middle of being young to being old?
Like maybe you just turned 18?
Yeah, or yeah. Something else like that. I mean, like when you reach 65, does it change? And when you reach 18, obviously you brung that up, it must change a little bit, right?
Yeah, well, you know, the right to self-determination is a human right. Legally, when somebody turns 18, they are able to make some legal decisions about their life, like where they live and who signs their paperwork and things like that. So we might be working with somebody who just turned 18 a little bit more differently than we would work with somebody who's 65 and maybe has a lot of a lifetime of experience in making decisions about their life and advocating for themselves. That's one of the roles that a brokerage can play, is in supporting people to learn more about what it means to make decisions about your life and be self-determined.
That sounds like quite an education process. Just out of curiosity, I think you had said back a little bit in the interview that people who are in group homes or foster care homes do not have the option of being on the brokerage side of services. Is their self-determination still part of the system, or is it kind of, I mean, no offense to anybody on where or why they receive services, but I want to stick with my brokerage.
Mm-hmm. I think that Oregon is still learning how to instill the principles of self-determination all throughout the system. It's been kind of an evolution, and people standing up for their rights and demanding that they have the options and choices and resources available to them is a work in progress. So I think that's kind of where Oregon is at with self-determination.
So we're getting there, but we still have a very long ways to go.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So, John, I have a question for you. What do you think is great about brokerage services?
Let's hope we got enough time for everything. Well, I came to brokerage services kind of late in life. I was diagnosed somewhere around my 40s or somewhere around there and didn't get actually in on the beginning of brokerage services. But I've been with the same brokerage for ever since I got into the service. And I've always appreciated the fact that it seems to be responsive to the customers, that it's constantly looking out for and advocating for customer needs. It's always trying to come up with new and innovative ways of dealing with customer problems and issues. And the fact that it never seems to give up, despite the endless, stupid bureaucracy that is constantly thrown in its way. The infinite amount of stupid red tape that never ceases and costs taxpayers and everybody else a huge sum of time and money for no damn good reason.
Thank you for sharing that with me, John.
You're welcome. Thanks once again for coming in. This has been Sarah Nowak, Director of UCP Brokerage. I hope to have you back again soon.
I would love that. Thanks for having me today. This has been really fun.
Yeah, we look forward to the next time we talk to you.
Sounds good.
Last month, we had Alan and Nico from Real Choice Initiative. This month, they are beginning their study. Dina, could you read from their website?
Sure thing, John. Their website is realchoiceoregon.com. And on it, they say, if you live in Portland and have disabilities or serious health concerns, they want to hear from you. And they invite you to take their survey. The Real Choice Initiative and Portland State University's School of Government were selected to lead a study about civic engagement in the disability community. This April, we will launch a survey to ask our community about ways to make city government more accessible and better suited to the needs of people with disabilities. Please sign up for our newsletter to stay up to date and take the survey. So if you scroll down to the bottom, you can find their email address, or you can write it down right now. It's Allen, A-L-L-E-N, at realchoiceoregon.com. So go to their website to begin this study. They're really needing some, I think it's 300 or 400 folks they're trying to interview.
Thank you, Dina. I hope to be the very first one to take the survey. We are recording here at home, so if you hear a dog in the background, that's what's going on. Do to stay home, stay healthy.
Speaking of stay home, stay healthy, here are some Facebook pages you might want to check out. Reimagining Recovery is a group that typically meets at the Q Center or Tabor Space, but if we're still doing stay home, stay healthy, you can do some online groups such as Sleep Hygiene Basics, Cultivating Self-Compassion, Wired for Survival, Understanding Your Fight, Flight, Freeze, Fawn Response. So check them out for different online groups. And another one is Public Annex. On their Facebook page, they say, being in quarantine doesn't mean we have to be without community. We have decided to offer online prompts that we can all do at home, together yet separate, as a temporary substitute for our weekly collaborative art classes. We will post a new prompt every Wednesday at 10:30 a.m. that you can work whenever you choose. And then you can post them.
That's the end of Disability Justice. Since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email, disabilityjustice@kboo.org.
Also, we're always looking for fun, inexpensive things to do out in the community. Go to disabilityjustice@kboo.org to contact us and give us your ideas.
listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, May 2nd from 7 to 10 p.m. for KBOO's Stay Home and Dance Party, where we can celebrate our community while maintaining the social distancing necessary to keep our community safe and